The U.S. Department of Interior has announced a new investigation into residential boarding schools across the United States. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, who is Laguna Pueblo, says that her department, having operated boarding schools for so long, is, quote, uniquely positioned to assist in the effort to recover the dark history of these institutions that have haunted our families for too long. All this follows recent and dreadful revelations on the other side of the Great Lakes. Two mass graves of children at residential boarding schools at opposite ends of Canada. Michigan's history is not exempt from this story. With us today to talk more is Natan Kiogima, Anishinaabemowin language specialist at the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. And Eric Hemingway is with us too. He's director of archives and records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands. Eric, Natan, it's nice to have you. Welcome to Stateside.
Buju ani minobimose koi indigenous migizen do dam waganaxing odawa indo dependagos nijo medeko indao. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
So there were no less than three federal boarding schools in Michigan that were part of a much broader effort across the U.S. and Canada to quash indigenous culture and assimilate indigenous people into white culture. Eric, can you tell us a little bit about where the boarding school system came from?
The boarding schools started out as part of a larger mission by the federal government to assimilate and quote unquote civilize Native people. And it's part of this larger idea that Natives were quote unquote savages, heathens, uncivilized. And a lot of the schools started out as what we call mission schools. And these schools were actually joint operations between local tribal communities and the local denomination that was there, whether it's Catholic or Protestant. But it's very important to note that many of these schools were cooperatives between the Native families who chose to send their kids to these schools and be Christian with that denomination. They weren't forced to do this. And a lot of these schools would later transition into government boarding schools. Like Holy Childhood started out as a mission school in the 1820s, but then it became a formal government boarding school in the 1880s.
Yeah. Where were these schools? And do we know anything about who was sent there?
Well, there was hundreds of schools across the country. And we had three government operated schools here in Michigan, one up in Baraga, one here in Harbor Springs, the Holy Childhood, and then one down in Mount Pleasant, the industrial school. And Native kids would come from different areas to these schools. So, for example, at Holy Childhood, it was very common to have Ojibwes from the western end of the UP in Wisconsin. And it was very common for our kids to go to other schools such as Mount Pleasant. But then we had kids go to Genoa, Kansas, Carlisle, Pennsylvania. So there was a lot of rearranging of people. And this also, in my mind, follows in this idea of removal that was prevalent in the 1830s and 40s. Removal was still going on in the late 1800s and early 1900s of kids.
Yeah. Natan, what did you hear about or what did you know of these schools growing up? Did you have much access to the history of boarding schools in Michigan?
I would say not until I was a teenager. I had a lot of history with like protest and activism with my parents being in AIM with the American Indian Movement. So I always, you know, knew I was Native. I always was proud to be Native. It was hard, but I didn't come into language revitalization and knowledge of language until I was a teenager and kind of going on my own journey of, you know, as just trying to figure out who I was. And that's kind of when I came into hearing and learning about what happened to our, you know, ancestors, what happened to our people. And I started to become more aware, more interested of how Native languages were, you know, still in danger.
Right. Eric, what about you? Did you have any family members who had stories to tell about boarding schools or just older folks you might have talked to?
My story is much like Natan's. I didn't start to realize or know about the boarding school. So I was a little bit older, and my mom, like Natan's mom, was into activism and protest. So I would be taken to these certain events, whether it's, you know, we protested the Big Rock nuclear plant when that was going on, and there was anti-Native fishing protests that we would go and protest against in Charlevoix. But during all of this, it was brought up that, you know, this institution was in our backyard called the boarding school, and that it wasn't the best place for Native, especially kids. So that was my first introduction to the school. And then as I got into my career as a researcher, I was really drawn towards this, what this institution was. And then it became this larger picture of not just Harbor Springs or the Odawa, but Native people across North America and the world, that this idea of colonizing Native people is widespread. And the hardest part of the colonization, or the most direct, is when you start to target kids.
It was impossible not to feel a sense of shock about what happened at the Merivale and Kamloops sites. And given how recent the history is in Michigan's tribal communities, what kinds of conversations have you been hearing amongst friends about what happened in these discoveries?
When this started coming about, it is shocking to hear it, but I already knew about mass graves. Like those have already been talked about within Native communities, families, and any kind of Native institution. And this was kind of the first one that came up, like on social media. Like we already knew just by sharing with each other and talking with each other, you know, we know that there's mass graves at certain boarding schools here in the U.S. and in Canada. My first time even going to one was the school in Canada, boarding school. I believe it's in Spanish. And I was actually in a language institute. And during this institute, the teachers there, who are fluent speakers now, but they were sent to these boarding schools to, you know, to colonize them, to assimilate them. And they actually, there are some students that kept their language. And a lot of those students are language teachers now. In my case, our two teachers were residential boarding school survivors. And so we went to the school, and they told us, you know, these horrific stories, and you could see the pain in their eyes while they were looking at the school. It was like the school, of course, was just like, it just looked like a just remnants. It was like a skeleton of this building, and we're looking at it and watching them looking at it was very striking, because you could see and feel the pain, and they were telling us the stories about what would happen, what they saw, what they witnessed. And then there was a lake there that they were talking about. They knew students, children their age, who tried to swim across this lake, and they would drown. And so even going to the lake and knowing that Native children drowned in this lake because they were trying to escape and trying to go back home, I mean, it was just like, it's like a reality. You're just like stricken, like, oh my gosh, like this happened, you know, and we're here, and we're in this language institute now, this school that's trying to bring our language back. And so it was something very painful and kind of beautiful at the same time, because here I am, because of your sacrifice, I'm able to stand here and learn my language from the survivors. So Native people knew that this has been going on, but it was never mainstream like it is now.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Natan Kiogama, Anishinaabemowin language specialist with the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians, and also with Eric Hemingway, director of archives and records for the tribe. Eric, in terms of the historical record, what kind of documents and stories do we have of people's times at Michigan's residential schools?
Well, the records are widespread, and I always want to include the oral histories of the survivors as a primary source. That just because it's not written down doesn't mean it's, you know, not as valid as other sources. And so with the written record, it's really spread out, and it's been really difficult, you know, collecting some of these records. The rectory for the Holy Childhood Church burned in the 1970s out in Cross Village. So a large number of records literally went up in smoke. And we've been seeing a lot of records on, of all places, eBay. Like, people have these private collections of Holy Childhood materials. I'm not quite sure where they got them from, but they're coming up for sale. So it's just everywhere you can think of. And we collect all that we can. And a lot of this is just very like stats of, you know, how many kids were in the school. Sometimes we have names, rosters, postcards, photos, letters. So we're trying to piece together the story as much as we can. But then also being mindful that when putting the story together, there's a lot of trauma involved. There's a lot of pain that goes into the story, and approaching this with that sensitivity, because I personally didn't go to the boarding school. I went to a one-room schoolhouse on Cross Village and then went to Harbor Springs. But, you know, I've known people that have gone there. They've had very traumatic experiences. And some people didn't have traumatic experiences. So it's a very complicated story. But the story remains that it was a place where a lot of kids experienced this abuse. And so having that story come out, or having the ability to tell that story, has been really touchy. And I, you know, some people come forward and tell the story, but they don't, you know, have it recorded, or they don't write it down. And so it's passed on orally, which is our tradition. So it's been a tough go to get this information. But then at the same time, you know, how to manage that information once you obtain it, because we have so many survivors that are still with us to this day. And this is the anomaly that's Holy Childhood, that it went on in operation for decades after the majority of other schools closed. So it officially closed in 1983, and the largest boarding school in the country at Carlisle closed in 1924. So that kind of tells you the story of Holy Childhood. So we have a lot of people who went there in the 60s and 70s, and they did not have good experiences. And a lot of kids didn't make it out of Holy Childhood. You know, they are buried around that school. So it's a very, very sensitive piece of our history, piece of our story. So it's one thing to collect it, but then how do you tell the story?
Nathan, I've got to believe that the history of boarding schools is really integral to the work that you do in helping people reserve and use their language. How do you see the legacy of those schools impacting the tribal community today?
It is such a motivation with our department and our staff. I've been here for 8 years now, and I would say almost every couple of years, every few years, we've lost the last of our fluent speakers here. They all went to boarding schools, and some of the stories that I remember and some of the stories that the language department actually has recorded, because I know that my director here has actually gone out and recorded some of those speakers before they left. And there was only, that I can think of now, there was only four. There was three women and three men, and they've all have passed on since I've worked here. So it just shows you the criticalness of it, of, you know, our language, you know, becoming extinct within the next 20 years. On LTBB Odawa, on our reservation, as of now, we do not have a fluent speaker anymore. The last one, actually, one of our last speakers, actually just passed recently. So, you know, we work constantly and daily on preserving and revitalizing language. And of course, in their memory and in their honor, but it is, you know, it is so urgent, you know, to get not only the language recorded, but we're trying to get the language to be in daily use again as a daily natural conversation.
Tell me a little bit more about the work that you do and what resources you think are most helpful in terms of making communities and their language whole again. I know some tribes, you know, that have a radio station, you know, kind of incorporated into their programming. There are some tribes in the U.S. where schools are able to actually do full-on classes. Where are you focusing your efforts right now, and what would you hope to do in the coming years?
So there's only three language instructors pretty much in the community. And we all can't be placed in a school, right? That's just not a reality. So I was teaching in the high school. So I was in Harbor High School and Petoskey High School. So in Petoskey, I would teach Anishinaabe Mohen 1 and 2 in the mornings. And then I would go over to Harbor Springs, which is about a 20-minute drive, go to that high school and teach Anishinaabe 1 and 2 in the afternoons. So that was very tough, but I was, you know, I was doing it. And there were so many high schools that wanted language as a choice for world language for graduation. And we had so many local high schools that wanted us, you know, that were requesting Anishinaabe Mohen in their high school. And we just couldn't do it because pretty much I was the only teacher doing that at that time. So our efforts right now, what we're really focused on is online and virtual. We're able to reach a wider range of tribal members and students, you know, going virtual and going online. So we've been really concentrating on that. And when the pandemic hit, we actually had a community class. It was face-to-face, and there was maybe, I would say, 10 students, some of them families, some of them would bring in their families. And we actually have a fluent speaker that works for our tribe. She's not from here, but she's Anishinaabe Kwe from Shishiguaning Wequemagong Reserve in Ontario. And that reserve in Ontario has the closest dialect to our Odawa dialect. So we've really learned a lot from them. Our past fluent speakers have been hired from there. So that is, you know, that's where we get a lot of our resources and a lot of our support. So she's from there. She also went to a boarding school. I'm not sure which one in Canada, but she also, I believe it was just a day school. But I know when she tells us stories, her grandmother actually took her and her siblings and they hid when the Canadian government came around to collect First Nations children, Native children. They call them First Nations in Canada. It's the same thing as we call them here, Native children. So when they came around to collect children, she hid. And so her grandmother took all of them and they would go hide in the woods. They actually had a camp. So even though she did go to a day school, she didn't go to the actual boarding school where they took them away from the families. So she was able to go and, you know, learn English, but she kept her language. So did her siblings. And I think they kept their language because their grandmother did that, took them and hid them so they wouldn't be taken away. And she had a community class that was open to the community. You didn't even have to be tribal to take the class. She just wanted to, you know, get our language out and for everyone to become aware, you know, of who we are. And this is how we sound. This is our language. So that was going on. The pandemic hit. So we had to think fast. Okay, what are we going to do to keep this community class going? And so we got on Zoom. We got an account. And we started a community class, one for beginners, one for a little more advanced students. And we did that every week.
Are there specific actions that you would like to see come out of the Interior Department's investigations?
As far as what's going on in Canada, you know, to our First Nation relatives, I think it's America's turn now to bring this, you know, up in front. So what I would also like to do as part of healing is I would also like to request from our TIPO director, that's Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, and then it's Eric as well, is maybe we need to start doing the underground radar or the, I don't know how do you say that, the seismic The machine that found, the technology that found all of those graves at Kamloops, I think we need to do that here at Holy Childhood.
Yeah, just to explain for folks, the Canadian boarding school sites, this is a technology that really made it possible. Obviously, a lot of folks have some sensitivity about, whether or not those children who died there should be exhumed. But there are things that can be done to deliver more information about the sites if tribes are able to make it happen. Eric, have you heard about whether Interior is interested in taking it that far with the investigations it's doing in the United States?
No, I just seen the announcement by Deb that this is going to be an investigation, and it's going to take years. I mean, there's so many of these schools, and the amount of work, it's going to be quite staggering, but tribes have resources that they can lend to this. You know, we have, you know, museums, archives, TIPOs, and it's going to be a joint collaborative, I feel. But as Natan was saying about, you know, identifying who's, in my mind, you have to identify. I'm not saying, you know, exhuming or taking anybody out of the ground, but you have to know if they're there. And this goes not just for Holy Childhood, but all these schools. And they have the technology that can do this, and it's non-invasive. You don't have to dig. So it's there.
This question of what things need to happen next to remedy what happened to language and what happened in boarding schools, it's really complex. For everyone who's got a piece of this, it's a very personal story, as you've both said. What do you both think is important to keep in mind, both in terms of accountability and overall in terms of healing? Natan, do you want to go first? And then Eric, I'm curious about what you have to say about this as well.
Well, that's, to me, I think healing is going to happen with our youth and that generational gap there of trying to connect our elders with our youth. From my experience of when I first heard our native language and when I connected with it and really was drawn to it was when I was a youth. So I think going into the high schools and trying to recruit language students was, you know, kind of one of the first, you know, tactics that we did and used. And that actually worked. You know, we did get some language students out of there. We did get, you know, passing that knowledge on. And when they grew up and they started having their kids, you know, so I guess just kind of planting that seed with our youth. And that's what we're doing, too, is we're developing online classes that are going in the high schools. So now that I'm pulled out of the high schools, we're developing these online classes. So now all the area high schools here in Northern Michigan and just in our county area can have those. So Petoskey and Harbor will be our pilot programs for these classes. Now, these classes are going to instill pride and knowledge and awareness to Native students. And they're also going to teach non-Native students, you know, who we actually are. You know, because all they're hearing is, you know, from media and from their own families and just from, you know, the more dominant society are pretty negative things about Native people still. And so this class also will kind of bridge that gap of making knowledge available and showing, you know, people who we are through the education system. So I think that's where a lot of healing is going to start too, is just understanding in education. And then when I say bridging the gap with our elders, bringing them together in the community class as well, you know, so trying to have a age range of like, okay, so we do the formal schooling with our high schools, and then we have a community class where we have families that are involved and generations that are involved. So I think trying to bring that back in is definitely a start.
Eric, what's on your mind about this?
Oh, quite a bit, actually. I mean, just having the truth about what happened coming out is a really important and first step to take, that Native people had to endure this on a large scale. And it's loss of life, it's loss of language, it's loss of culture, and it's loss in our own backyard. This isn't a faraway place we have to look to in Canada or Carlisle, it's Harbor Springs. and to have people realize that this happened within our own community, and the community being that of Northern Michigan, and that people are still dealing with what happened. And it's not just for that individual, it's also for the families and the community, because a lot of times these traumatic experiences are passed on to other individuals within the family or community. So it's this ripple effect that's gone through our tribe and other tribes, and to let people bring awareness that this happened, and that it was part of a plan essentially to make us be a non-Anishinaabe, to take the Anishinaabe out of us. And this is only for Native people. There wasn't these policies to make any other people white. There was only for Natives. So it's part of this larger plan by the federal government to erase our identity. And a lot of times people got erased in the process. This has been such a tidal wave of emotions. I mean, for myself personally and people around me, like, we know this happened, but when you see the numbers, it's staggering, and it just, you know, it's at these other schools.
Yeah.
And so just having that be known, and then also having the fact that we are not going to sit and be defined by this victimization. And I think Natan's points are very clear to that, that we're, you know, resilient, we're bouncing back, we're having language, we're having this stance that we're not going to buckle and we're going to move forward. So that's, I think, a very key message to drive forward, that this isn't going to define us, but it's part of us.
Eric Hemenway is director of archives and records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. And Natan Kiyogama is a language specialist for the tribe. Natan, Eric, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Nahau miigwech, ba mampi.
Thanks for having me again. Take care.